Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Today, we're thrilled to welcome Daniel Posner to our webinar series as we have a conversation today around investing in the face of uncertainty. By way of background, Daniel has spent nearly 30 years on Wall Street in various roles, squarely focused on distressed investing. Before founding his own private investment firm, Daniel was head of credit opportunities at D.E. Shaw and Golub. He was CIO of AllianceBernstein's energy opportunities business, and we're thrilled to have him on our show today. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you for having me, Charlie.
Great. Well, let's get right into it. Clearly, it's an unprecedented time in the market and in society. How's your blood pressure?
Thanks for asking, Charlie. I'm doing great. I appreciate it.
So I feel like investors are seeing lots of conflicting signals in the market. On the one hand, the pandemic has meant closed businesses in the tens of thousands, record unemployment numbers, and a tragic loss of life. On the other hand, last week, the NASDAQ briefly hit 10,000, which is an all-time high. S&P investors have regained all of their losses on the year. What should investors make of all of this?
Well, it's true that it really seems that there is a tale of two cities. On the one hand, you have the tens of thousands of small businesses and corporations who have shuttered, have closed their doors, have closed for the last 3 months, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of workers and millions of workers. On the other hand, you have the indices, the large markets, and the markets that are followed by the masses. And when you see reports on CNBC and the Wall Street Journal, you see that many of the S&P indices are at near highs, as you outlined. And it's true. There really are two different cities. On the one hand, when you look at the equity markets, the public markets, those markets are up nearly 40% from their lows, whereas the small corporates, they've yet to come back. They're only now slowly starting to reopen, and we'll see how those come out. But I think that's really the lifeblood of our economy. If you look at the public markets, for example, the equity markets, the S&P 500, which is made up of 500 companies, five of those companies make up many of the largest companies have been able to navigate the COVID crisis extraordinarily well. Certainly their stock prices have shown that. I mean, it's largely because many of the Wall Street analysts are looking at 2020 as just a wash. And they're saying these companies really shouldn't be valued on the basis of what happened during this kind of crisis. And they're looking at the future cash flows of those companies and businesses. Whereas many of the smaller companies, they're not looked at in the public markets. They're pretty much looked at on a cash flow basis by their owners. And we'll see how those come out in the next several months and the next year or two.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and going to be very interesting to watch. It is fascinating that many professional investors are giving companies largely a pass on 2020. As you think about what the recovery might look like when it really does begin in earnest, economists seem to talk about lots of letters and how this might actually look and unfold. Some say V, some say U, some now, particularly with the potential of a resurgence in COVID come the fall, will say W, and others just sort of leave it as a question mark. Interesting data this week on clearly the Fed's bond buying program, but that against a potential fiscal cliff when unemployment benefits run out, but you've still got tens of millions of people who are unemployed. What's your view on what the rest of the year holds for us and what the recovery might actually look like?
Yeah, the truth is, whether we're in a V-shaped, W-shaped, or U-shaped, or question mark-shaped recovery, no one knows. And anyone who says that they know or thinks that they know will likely be wrong. We see that in many Wall Street prognostications, that whatever the course of their expectations are, generally, markets are very different. I think one of the things we will see is continued volatility. We're seeing that in the public markets. Last week, the market pulled back 6% one day. I think we'll continue to see that as we see more volatility, not just based on the COVID crisis, although that will be a leading dominating force. There are a number of different key critical items that will have an impact on where the markets trade, certainly in public markets scenario, including the political process, right? Depending on who's the president, the next president of the United States, that may have material impact on the direction of the marketplace. But there are a whole host of other issues, including geopolitical tensions, including how the economies around the world continue to grow or be able to come out of COVID. The China-US issue has been an issue that's been brewing and largely was shut down over the last, in January because of COVID. But I think that that will likely rear its head again in the coming months. So, look, I do believe that our markets will continue to be strong. The United States is a very, very strong economy. I have no reason to believe that we won't gather enough strength and steam to be able to come back as strong as we were before and even stronger. But that being said, there will be many starts and stops along the way as we see certain areas within the United States may start to surge again, as we expect, or start to see more cases that may have an impact on how quickly we open. We have many different state and local governments that are going to be running massive deficits. What will happen to how they run their local economies? All of those are key contributors to what happens in the coming 6 to 12 to 18 months. I think the key element with all of this, with the volatility, is volatility often creates unbelievable opportunity. One of the things that we've seen over the course of COVID is there's many lessons to be learned from COVID. But one lesson that we can learn is that when there are hosts of people that are selling, when you have non-economic sellers, people that are forced to get out, people whose risk managers are telling them you need to sell, those are often the best times to buy. And it's sometimes the hardest time to buy because it seems like the world is coming to an end. It seems like the markets are coming down significantly and may continue to go down, but those can be often the best times to be buyers in the marketplace. And I believe we'll continue to see those kinds of volatility to be able to have those kinds of opportunities, not only in the public markets, but also in, often to where Yield Street focuses its attention, to many of the smaller companies, the smaller businesses, to which many of those companies do not have the capital markets open to them. They do not have lenders that are lending to them. And those can create some really exciting opportunities for Yield Street and for our investors.
Yeah, agreed. You know, as I reflect on that, I started my career on Wall Street in 2000, just in time for the tech bubble to burst a couple years later. Special shout out to my former colleagues at Robertson Stephens. Then, like you, I saw what the 2008 to 2009 crisis meant on Main Street and Wall Street. I'm just wondering, as you were sitting in your seat, as a distressed investor at DSHOT and then Golub through those periods, how does that impact your view of the crisis today? And specifically, how the individual investors who are joining us on the line today might think about, their own portfolios?
Yeah, clearly I have a lot of gray hair, and a lot of that might be due to going through a number of these crises. But one of the things, that we learn from going through these crises is that companies that have good cash flows, good fundamental businesses, those are businesses that will continue to be strong throughout and after they get through the process. That's one of the things we're going to learn through this crisis, is that we're seeing a fundamental pivot in many industries about how they operate. We'll see that as we go into retail stores and we see the plastic glass in front of them. We'll see that in transportation and how they operate. And any business that's any professional environment, whether it's telecommuting or thinking about how much presence do we need to have in our offices. A lot of people are going through that transformational thought process. And I think we'll see that continue over the next year or two. But I think the key element is when there are dark clouds overhead, generally when things feel like they can't get any worse, sometimes those are good times to be buying. When the world feels like it's falling apart, usually you wake up the next morning and the sun rises and things often get better. And so it's really about staying focused to companies that continue to have strong assets, have strong ability to have cash flows.
So moving to distressed investing specifically, let's start sort of high level. How do you define it? And then let's talk about two things. Number one, which sectors you think are most likely to experience distress coming out of this crisis? And then picking up on what you were just talking about, where, as a result, investors are likely to find the best opportunities?
So where can Yield Street investors go to find opportunities? I think it's a great question. One of the areas that Yield Street caters to is smaller companies. Many of those companies will have difficulty raising capital. The banks, many of them are focusing on the real estate market. Many of them focus on really their own balance sheets and continuing to make sure that those are stable. And I'd say their lending to small and medium-sized businesses largely dissolved. And I think that's one of the areas that Yield Street investors can focus on to find great opportunities in the marketplace. I think that the small and medium-sized companies are really the lifeblood of our economy. And it's also a way for Yield Street investors to, you know, one of the big areas of the marketplace today is, you know, how can our views about the world, how can we reflect them in how we invest? And I think investing in kinds of companies that have similar thematic views and values that we all have would be a great way for investors to spend their capital and focus their attention. And I think with all of the discussion now that's happening, it can be so powerful to put your money where your mouth is. And many of these small and medium-sized companies have the ability to create all sorts of value in all different kinds of communities. And I think that is an area that Yield Street will continue to focus on and a way for small and high net worth and ultra high net worth investors to get access to and focus on. A couple of the other areas that I work on and focus on are the credit markets. I spent a lot of time focusing on the high yield and investment grade credit markets. That market backed up dramatically in March and April, and we saw massive tightening coming through at the end of April, May, and into June. And a lot of that is from what's called the Fed put, where the Fed raised $2 trillion to go after and help companies and individuals to get through the COVID crisis. And, you know, I think what we've seen from that is that many assets, including the equity markets, the public corporate credit markets, have largely inflated on the basis of that. And people call that the Fed put, which means that if the Fed has got their capital out, if they're going to be buying bonds in the marketplace, if they're going to be flooding the markets with capital or telling banks that they need to lend and lowering interest rates to zero, what that means is that large banks are going to need to lend and lower interest rates so that people continue to invest in the markets. And while that will create potentially a bubble or largely inflated or fully valued public markets, the smaller and mid-sized companies are sometimes left out of that. And that could be where some great opportunities lie for Yield Street investors.
We've got some great questions in the chat box, so I want to go to those and we'll work through them. Thank you, and please keep them coming. First question is, are there ways that investors can minimize the impact of the economic downturn without selling off investments?
Well, I'd say that, you know, one of the worst times to be a seller is, you know, when markets trade down significantly. And sometimes that's, you know, people need to raise money. Probably investors should only be investing in volatile assets if they don't need that capital or they don't need that money immediately, because that is the worst time to be selling. And that's really what people need to avoid. What we often see in the markets is that retail investors, they'll often start to see a market trade down, and then they'll be nervous and won't really do much. And then they'll see the second or third leg down, and then they get really, really nervous and decide to sell. And that's often when professional investors come in and they scoop up what's called as distressed bonds or distressed equities, They'll buy them at cents on the dollar. They might be able to buy airline bonds or automotive company bonds at 50, 60, 70 cents on the dollar. And as things start to normalize and as the markets continue to open up, those bonds will trade back up. And what we've seen over the last number of weeks, the equities have traded back up dramatically. And I think a couple of things that investors can do is, first of all, don't panic. You know, I think people make their best decisions when they keep their head down, when they stay focused, when they look at their long-term goals and objectives. And that's really what investing needs to be about. It can't be looking at your market and looking at your portfolio every day and deciding, do I like it or do I not like it? It has to be, at least for most retail investors, they have to look in a more long-term way. And I think the best way to generate the kinds of outsized opportunities and returns that individual investors can take on is by finding those opportunities that have the risk reward that really makes sense. And I think given this economic uncertainty, that creates the kinds of opportunities I think that our investors are looking for in finding for example, lending to really solid companies where you're making a 12 to 14 to 15% return, or even a 9 or 10%, but solid, stable companies or assets that are backed, those are, you know, one of the really, really great ways to put your capital in places that are safe with still gaining yield. You know, today's market environment, it's very challenging to find yield. You know, when interest rates are at zero, when you put your money into a bank account, it's earning significantly less than 1%.
Yeah, absolutely. And
that's tough for, certainly difficult for senior citizens to make their monthly payments. And it's difficult for individuals who want some kind of monthly income. And I think the benefit that Yield Street has is the access to those kinds of companies that enable, or investments that enable investors to get a really interesting yield on those kinds of asset-rich companies or asset-rich investments.
There's been so much talk and so much written about supply chain and how that may lead to a localization of manufacturing, meaning bringing what has been over the last several years offshore manufacturing back onshore and so forth. One participant asks a question, which is on that topic, which is, even for companies who have strong cash flow, they are still experiencing unusual and unprecedented supply chain issues that make operating unpredictable. How do you evaluate or suggest investors evaluate companies against that dynamic to ensure that there's still good investment opportunities?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question. And I think that's part of the evolving economy that we'll start to see, right? We'll start to see, just one example, healthcare. One of the things we've learned from COVID is that a lot of what we have in healthcare is outsourced. Many of the manufacturers of pharmaceuticals are in China or in other parts of Asia. A lot of that will be onshored. You know, many of the themes and areas of focus that we've had over the last decade or two, so sort of things like just-in-time inventory, right? And making sure that your sources of supply are really focused on one or two. Having diversification, I think, will become a much, much more big focus, right? Just another example, we have open office environments, right? Where people are all really next to each other and on top of each other. And the benefits of that is collaboration and communication and connectivity. Given COVID, given the potential for other sorts of viruses, I think people will be much more mindful about how is an office setup going to look like. We're going to be bringing on shore much of the manufacturing and technology that we've outsourced to places like China and Bangladesh and other areas. You know, and that could be a big boon to manufacturing in the United States. One of the nice things is that our energy prices are extraordinarily low, with oil prices at sub $40 a barrel, with natural gas prices at below $2, you have a great environment to be able to invest where costs are relatively cheap. You definitely have a labor force that is looking to get back to work. And I think with telecommuting and people working from home, I think that we will actually increase the size of the labor pool. There will be more people that companies will be able to give people the flexibility to work in the environment that they need to work in to manage both their work environment as well as their home environment.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting. The effect of that is certainly pronounced. Also, you know, there's this question about when the dip is going to be experienced in different markets, which I think is an interesting one. Daniel, as you and I have talked about before, this recovery is likely to be driven by consumers. I was listening, I think this was on Marketplace this morning. It's an interesting statistic that spending for lower earners has actually come back to pre-crisis levels. It's the top 25% of earners in the US that aren't spending at the same rates as they were before, largely because discretionary outlets for that spending really haven't been open. If you think about a city like New York, there's really no retail, obviously. No one's buying expensive meals, restaurants, so on and so forth. And so I wonder, like, as you think about those pockets of spending, where do you think that's likely to either get worse or better? There's a question on that topic directly in the chat room.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So, look, I think we've seen spending. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the data today is anecdotal, and we don't have enough information and data or even time to be able to assess or analyze what's the direction. Clearly, people on the lower end are spending some of that money. Both, maybe some of them have gotten government checks and are using that money to spend on things like electronics, or they may have more time on their hands and they're using their online systems. And I spoke anecdotally to a number of retailers and to a number of merchants, and their feedback to me was interesting. So, you know, one was a jeweler who's, you know, got major clients in the retail world. And he said that his business in the retail was down pretty significantly at some of the companies, but at companies like Costco or large big box retailers that have been open, that business has been pretty flat, which is surprising to me. And on the other hand, the online business has grown tremendously to offset the other business. So, you know, on balance, his business has been pretty much stable to slightly up, which would have been very different than my expectations, right? I would have expected the retail to be completely, you know, gone down to zero, and then the big box or the online maybe up slightly, but not up as significant as he mentioned. But I think what it goes to show is that, you know, the American consumer continues to be strong. I think people are seeing this as a, you know, in some ways a 2 to 3 month shutdown, and there is light at the other end of this tunnel. And I think subject to how we come out of this over the next several months, how quickly we come out of this will depend on how quickly people will come back online. But it's interesting because, for example, you'll have many retailers that will have to blow out of significant amounts of their inventory, right? They had a whole selling season, their spring and summer season, that they largely lost, right? And so clearly orders in the third and fourth quarter of this year are going to be down, even if there was some spending in the earlier part of the year, I think. And there's also a trend towards minimalism, where people are saying, well, you know, I'm working from home, you know, how much clothes do I really need? I think a lot of people have done a lot of nesting and cleaning and making sure that they focus on just the parts of their household that they need and not all the things that we've been buying. And then, you know, the economy that we've been so used to over the last number of years, where you just buy and then throw it away, I think people are starting to think about things like the environment and things like minimalism. And those trends, I think, will continue for some period of time.
Yeah, it certainly impacted different sectors of the economy in different ways. There's a question in the Q&A about hotels and lodging, specifically on the commercial real estate front. And the question is, do you see opportunities available in this sector due to less supply because of the closures that have happened, and that there may eventually be a rebound for the survivors? That sort of plays into a distressed investing theme in hotel and lodging specifically.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think there's really two sides of the investment arena that I focused on. There's been the companies that have been able to adapt and have actually benefited from COVID. You know, Amazon would be an example of that kind of company, and many of the technology companies that have, and healthcare companies that have been able to excel because of it. And then the other area is really many of the cyclical companies, including the energy companies, the transportation companies, the lodging companies. And I've really had a barbell approach to investing. And I think that is where you can find some value and finding opportunity sets. The lodging is a particularly interesting one. And I think the commercial real estate market is particularly interesting as well. In lodging, look, I think there are a couple of elements. There's one element that is, I think people are feeling a real need to get out. People have been at home 2-3 months. Many to most children have been learning through Zoom. And I think it's also a very individualized, individualistic question that people ask themselves is how comfortable do they feel? And I think different people have different risk metrics and feel comfortable with COVID and the potential to contract the disease and how vulnerable they are and how serious it is. And I think it's also different based on where you live. There are certain parts of the country that I've seen, especially in the Northeast, especially those areas that have been really hard hit, including New York, New Jersey, the metro New York area, Michigan, where people, and especially vulnerable people, I think in those areas, people are continue to be in a very high state of alert and nervous about contracting the disease. And yet in other areas, including places like Florida, and based on what I've seen, based on what I've read about, people feel much more comfortable in that. And then, you know, as we've seen cases spike, you know, a lot of is what is the data telling us? One of the things we do know is that testing has gone up dramatically. And so sometimes we can see the numbers, but also the interpretation of those numbers is as important, if not more important, than the numbers themselves. So the question is it we have more cases because we're testing more, or do we have more cases because people are not socially distancing properly? Nobody really knows the answer to that, and we'll find out over the period of time. But I think specifically to hotels, you know, I think there are certain businesses that are doing more telecommuting. Question is how much business travel will come back. I do think that there will be more personal travel. Will people be willing to get on the planes? And will businesses push people on planes? What we've started to see as the airlines are opening up flight, there is real demand. And so I think we'll continue at least over the summer, start to see those numbers go in a certain path. And then it really will depend on which direction does the disease take and what happens with COVID. If COVID sees an increase and we have to take a couple steps back, I think that will dramatically hurt the hotel business. If it doesn't, then I think that we're back off to the races. And I think we'll start to see in the fourth quarter of this year and first quarter of next year that people will go back to where they started. On the commercial real estate side, I think that's a serious, serious issue. And I think there are two ways of thinking on it. On the one hand, I think the conventional ways and the way that most people look at it is why do commercial companies or why do big companies need as much commercial real estate as they had before? After all, people are going to be telecommunicating. You don't need people to be in the office all the time. Isn't Zoom so efficient that we can just pop on our Zoom and roll out of bed in the morning? On the other hand, there are a whole host of people that really benefit and thrive in an office environment. Be able to challenge your colleagues, to see them, to have a social community. That's important for many, many, many people. And I think the office environment may require larger distancing between people. We may have more offices that people need can have their own space in, as opposed to more people within a smaller amount of space. And so I think that there'll be a tension back and forth on that front. And we probably won't see the result of that for many, many months from now. But I think going into 2020, 21 and beyond, we'll continue to have that dialogue and conversation. I think the short term will be that people will pull back on office space, especially small and mid-sized companies. But I think the larger companies will rethink their office space and rethink about how best to utilize it.
Of course, the counter to that, of course, is that if everyone's going to need to be 6 feet away, we may in fact need more office space if people are actually going to start going again. So it remains to be seen. Shift gears a little, Daniel. What do you think about some non-traditional asset classes? There's a great question in the Q&A on that topic, which is, what are some interesting non-traditional asset classes like art, crypto, Airbnb, real estate that you think might present some interesting opportunities? And how would you think of deploying capital? Out of the box.
I think many of the non-traditional asset classes, I think there will continue to be some real interest and excitement in those areas. And it really is very much facts and circumstances, depending on the market and the environment. You know, one of the things in the non-traditional assets, you know, some of the benefits of them is that many of them are not correlated to the overall markets. And so they don't have these massive down 50%, up 30%, volatility of down 6% in a day. You're investing in in assets that have really, really strong protection and downside and ability to make sure to get your capital back and your principal back plus a nice interest. And I think given the volatility and risk management and oversight in many of these alternative assets and specialty assets, I think that there will be in the coming months lots of opportunities. We're seeing this on our platform with our pipeline, whether it's art finance or real estate or litigation finance. I think that there will continue to be. I think that the litigation finance area, the specialty finance area, lending to law firms, that will continue to be a really exciting area. That's an area where it requires a significant amount of investment up front. Litigation over the course of the last several years has drawn out to the point where some of these trials will take 3, 4, 5+ years, and law firms simply don't have the cash and capital to be able to pay the staffs required to litigate those deals. And so to be involved in lending against those assets and lending against those cases with potential upside, those can create some really exciting opportunities. But I do think that anytime where you find a hard asset that protects your downside and gives you a current yield, those are hard to find. And I think because the market is so thirsty for yield, it can be competitive. But when you have the kind of volatility that we've seen over the last few months, it sometimes loosens up some of those asset classes that are a bit more off the run.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, when you think back to your time coming out of the 08 and 09 crisis, where did you see investors do the best? And like, which of those sectors came back online most quickly? Like, where should investors really be looking
to? Yeah, so, you know, that's a good point. So what we saw in the 08 crisis, the markets traded down, really starting in parts of real estate and commercial real estate, really started trading down in 07. And then we really, Bear Stearns blew up in March of 2008. And then it wasn't until September, October, when Lehman blew up in 2008, that really the market really just came down dramatically. I remember in the beginning of 2008, when Bear Stearns blew up, and I was working for D. Shaw at the time, and I had conversations with folks like Larry Summers. And he said, you know, if there's a Democratic president, the big three will never go bankrupt. Well, you know, 6 months later, one of the big three automotive companies, General Motors, went bankrupt. And, you know, the beauty of bankruptcy and restructuring process is that creditors are the first groups that get paid. And so being able to be at the top of the capital structure to get paid back first is really, really critical and important. And that's why investing in the United States and being able to have your legal bankruptcy protections and be able to go after what's yours, it really has created a pro-business environment that enables creditors to lend at a comfortable pace and feel like their principal is protected. And that's what we've seen. The companies and businesses that, and it, starting in October, when the market continued to trade off, it took a full 6 months of real pain before anything really started to trade back up. So we didn't really see, you know, a V-shape at all. It was a trend down in September, October, and then a straight line with some volatility in there, but really at the lower levels until really March, April of 2009. And then in 2009, you know, really we started to see from the middle to the back end of the year, asset prices started to come back. And what happens is the healthier markets, the credit market-wise, they can always issue paper. You know, these are companies that are borrowing at 3, 4, and 5%. These companies, they are the ones whose bonds will trade up most immediately. And then after that, it will become the high yield companies. And then after that, some of the equity companies will trade back up. But of course, you know, what you see is that there's just really a falling out. Many of the companies don't make it through to the next stage. Some of those companies like, for example, Lehman Brothers or WaMu, Washington Mutual, many of those companies will have to restructure through a bankruptcy process. And we saw companies like Conseco Finance and many of the cable companies like Adelphia, all of those companies filed for bankruptcies in the first cycle in the early 2000s and then in 2008. And then that really you know, created a lot of investing opportunities through those 6 months of period where people weren't sure where the opportunity set was and would the market get better or is the world just going to continue to spiral down?
What are some of the bankruptcies that you've seen already through this cycle? Hertz, probably at the top of the list, tell you about what's likely to happen?
Yeah. Well, bankruptcy processes generally take 18 to 24 months to work through the process and through the restructuring. Some of the companies that require financing and leverage, including a company like Hertz that requires financing, you know, those companies are going to go through a restructuring process. And I think the high quality companies will continue to exist and be strong businesses on the other side. I do think that there will be a rental car market. I do think Hertz will be around. It will just be a much smaller business or a smaller company. Likely it may get consolidated or there may be M&A in that industry and to another company. I would think that another company would want to buy their market share. So, you know, one of the big areas of restructuring has been in the energy sector. There's been dozens and dozens of companies that have gone through restructurings. With oil prices going from $60 down to the 20s and now recovered somewhat from the lows, but most of the companies in the industry can't really be profitable until oil gets to about $50 a barrel. And as people are starting to reevaluate things like the environment and alternative energy. And while today it's a very, very small piece of the overall energy supply as well as consumption, I believe that will continue to grow at a pretty dramatic rate. We'll continue to have lower consumptions of energy, and I think we'll be more efficient with the way we have energy. And I think the traditional oil and gas markets, which have forever been a lifeblood of our economy, will continue to have a lower and lower piece of our economy. But that being said, it's not going away. We still require nearly 10 billion gallons of barrels of oil per year to just exist as a global economy. You know, it's somewhere in the 9 to 10 range now. And that's been largely stable to slightly growing as the third world economies are largely using mainly traditional oil to continue to build their economies. Now, but I do think that that will continue to change. So I think that market's not going away over the next 10 to 20 years, but I think in the very short term, it's going to be very difficult to invest in a sector that can't make money. And at the end of the day, as a cash flow investor, as a value investor, as finding opportunities in growth markets, very hard to invest in a sector where they can't make money.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today and fielding all of these questions. Apologies to all the participants for some of the audio trouble. I think we can all be empathetic. It's one of the downsides of working from home, but we certainly appreciate, Daniel, your insights. So thank you for joining us. To all our participants, thank you also for taking the time out of your busy days to join us, and in particular for such thoughtful questions. We appreciate it. Just a reminder to please visit yieldstreet.com to learn more about our offerings. And if you're an originator yourself, please be sure to click through on the Raise Capital page or to reach out to our originations team. It is originations@yieldstreet.com. With that, we'll break. Thanks again, everyone. Stay safe and healthy. We appreciate your time today. Thanks again, Daniel.
You're welcome. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.